Welcome back, my friends, to AA Recovery Interviews. I'm your host, Howard L., and I'm an alcoholic. Sober since January 1st, 1988, one day at a time. I'm grateful you've joined us. AA Recovery Interviews is the podcast where Alcoholics Anonymous members from around the world share their extraordinary stories of experience, strength, and hope. There are over 145 interviews in this podcast series, all of which you can enjoy on aarecoveryinterviews.com and all podcast apps. My guest on today's show, John G., started drinking in his adolescence and continued into his 30s when the disease of alcoholism had him firmly in its clutches. By then, his use of methamphetamines had also spiraled out of control. Instead of supplanting John's alcoholism, his drug addiction fueled his drinking until that ruinous combination threatened his job and virtually every other aspect of his life. Though he knew he needed to get sober, early attempts were half-hearted at best and led to still more misery. Even inpatient treatment for 4 weeks was insufficient to quell his desire for drugs and alcohol, and he slipped almost immediately upon discharge. As he approached the edge of the abyss, John experienced a moment of clarity. That brief break in his clouded thinking was enough to convince him that he had to get sober or he would not survive. John turned himself over to the simultaneous attendance of IOP and regular AA meetings. As he became more and more grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous, he put the program on top of his daily priorities. His service commitments in AA further cemented his dedication to his own sobriety and that of his fellows. Because John and I have attended many of the same meetings over his tenure in AA, we've gotten to know each other quite well. As such, I can personally vouch for the quality and integrity of his program and the impact it has had on other AA members. I feel like his is a story that will be readily identifiable to listeners. It's full of the kind of wisdom and perspective that inspire Alcoholics Anonymous members everywhere. I hope you will enjoy the next hour with my good friend and AA brother, John G.
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
Hi, Howard.
That's the correct response. Most people get it every time. I'm so glad you and I are able to sit down like this evening. As I've done in a lot of other interviews, I've chosen Sunday night after the meeting to do the podcast recording in this beautiful room that we meet at every Sunday night at this beautiful retreat center in Houston. And it's quiet. The chairs are comfortable. I've been wanting to do an interview with you for a long time, and we've been talking about it, and so finally I have you here. So I want to really thank you for that.
My pleasure.
What did you think about some of the things that were being said tonight?
Honestly, I was only thinking about my lost prospect this week.
Oh, really?
I had a text message a few days ago from a guy I reached out to at Avenue B, and he said he's living in a halfway house, and text basically said, "Hey, I really need to get into these steps. Can you help?" So I texted him back. No, I actually called him back, but he was in a house meeting. And I said, anytime, just give me a call. And since that week had gone by, I hadn't heard from him. So now I'm in that place where you have to either let the person go or decide, am I going to, you know, reach out again? And I, you know, it's a little awkward. It happens.
The important thing, though, it sounds to me like you're available for him. You picked up. You were ready to take action, help him with his step work.
Yes.
That's what we learned. And, of course, you've been around a long enough time to have had that experience with being a sponsor and having a sponsor. When did you first get sober? What's your sobriety date?
December 12, 2004.
So you're coming up on 20 years at the end of this year.
Yes, 19 years and 2 months. I feel like I'm in the downhill slide to 20.
Those Dos Equis are they're some of the best years. They were for me, and that I think it had a lot to do with where I was in my family and some other things. It was also a time of some of the tragic things that have happened in sobriety, but you never know when those things are going to happen, so it's important to make sure that you're ready for them when they do. You mentioned to me about sponsorship at another time where we were talking about the success rate or the number of people that get sponsored who don't get it. What's your experience been with over the years with trying to help guys and it not taken?
Honestly, I've felt very blessed in that area. I'd say the entire time I've been sober, I've gotten at least one, sometimes multiple guys through the steps in the same year. And a lot of the time they have gone through all 12 with me, so I'm very grateful for that. But this past year has not been as many, so I need to get back into it. The meeting tonight was a great reminder.
Yeah. How do you deal with it when somebody that you're sponsoring falls off the grid or doesn't call back or lets you know that they're not ready? How does that feel when you get that news?
It used to bother me a lot more, but it doesn't so much. But my perspective about that is changing now because a friend of mine recently passed away, and I remember that just the other year, two mm-hmm. years ago, we were at Whole Foods just having a cup of coffee. He was brand new. He wasn't asking me to sponsor him, but it was kind of a reach-out meeting. Mm-hmm. And to think that he's not here anymore, I always ask myself, maybe I could reach out some more and just do more calling people to see how they're doing. And, you know, it's just, it's strange. It's sad to know that you were just meeting someone who was new to the program. He was wanting to find out about sobriety and now they're gone. So, but I've never chased anyone down who stopped calling.
Yeah. And of course, in my early days of sobriety, it was all about the phone. Mm-hmm. And you give somebody your phone number and they'd either call or they wouldn't. But I mean, the number of calls that I got versus those I didn't, maybe 10% of the time people will actually call. You got sober through a treatment center?
I would say after the treatment center in 2003. And 18 months later, I got sober. But it was from basically working with a sponsor at my apartment at the time.
Were you inpatient at all?
Yes, 28 days inpatient.
Okay. A lot of stories get confusing because of the time frames. So this is in 2003. 2003. Hmm. 28 days in. Chris D, was he there when you got sober?
Not only was he there, he was probably one of the most impactful people in my entire sobriety and recovery, because before I went into treatment, I was doing IOP with Chris, I was doing IOP, and I always trusted the guy. But I remember I was still using, and I was about 2 weeks into this class. It was meeting on Thursdays, and I just went into his office and said, "Hey, I'm totally full of bupkis. I've been using this whole time." And he didn't coddle me. I just remember he turned around in his chair and he looked at me and he said, "You know, John, you're chemically dependent." Hmm. And he gave me this look, and it was like, "Oh my gosh, this guy sees right through me." Because I was, talking about how I had other areas of my life still in control mm-hmm. and that I'd been using a little during his IOP. And he just saw right through me and he said, "You're chemically dependent."
Wow. So that was the beginning of the end for you, huh?
Yeah.
So at what point did he say that to you in the continuum of time that you spent at that facility?
It was before I ever checked in. I was going to one or two meetings on my own power. I knew I had a problem.
These are AA meetings at that mm-hmm. facility?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
that's all people from the facility mostly, right?
Right.
Okay.
And you could say I crashed into inpatient treatment just a few weeks later. And when I showed up again, they didn't even make me do paperwork. They said, "Just go back there. They're waiting for you."
Did you have to detox?
Not really. Mm-hmm. There was no medical detox, but the first week I was up until 4 o'clock in the morning every night.
It must have been rough.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Did you have a roommate?
Yes, young guy named Zach. I have no idea where he is to this day, but I really connected with this guy. He had been to treatment before, so he kind of told me a few things. And I remember when we got out, he went straight off to Florida, and I never saw him again.
So. Never got a phone call or anything, mm-hmm. huh? Can you rewind your story a little bit for us and talk about what it was like growing up? Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a wonderful family in Meyerland. My mother is from Lamarck, Texas, Christian, and she married my father, a South African Jew, who came here to run track for U of H. So it was literally two people from opposite sides of the world. And my sister and I had a wonderful childhood. My father obsessed over sports, and my mother was the strict disciplinarian. So we had the balance of good grades were important, and I had all kinds of sports to do, you know, after school and growing up in a great place in Meyerland.
So you're one of a handful who I've interviewed and who I know in the program that talked about having really great childhoods. And that always really bugged me because I thought, I had such a miserable childhood. How could anybody have had the same problem I have with alcoholism if they came out of a great childhood? So I would ask you the same question. You had a great childhood. When and why and how did you get involved with alcohol and drugs?
Oh, what a question. The only time I ever even saw drinking was when I was around my mother's family. Mm. My grandfather, he lived to be 90, but he was probably a functional alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So there was always the booze around Christmas time and family gatherings. And I remember, so there was a little bit of drinking going around the family gatherings. Mm-hmm. But the first time I ever tried to drink, I was being rushed for a fraternity in Houston. Some friends from high school took me out with some Sigma Chi's as let's investigate this guy and go out for bowling. And I just remember we were in a bowling alley. And I was drinking beer from a pitcher, and the next thing I remember was some guy was watching me to make sure I didn't drown in a swimming pool later.
Oh, no. From bowling alley to swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. What was it like when you took your first drink? Did you enjoy it, or were you just waiting for the effects?
I enjoyed it. Another situation similar to that, going up to Austin to meet, you know, potential pledge brothers and fraternity brothers. And I ended up on top of a table just talking to the ceiling all night after drinking a few beers. Mm. So I didn't recognize it then. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
But, and there were probably a few times in high school where we would have keg parties. Mm-hmm. I remember being passed out in the front yard. Mm-hmm. And this is by the time I was 18, though. My father came out one evening, and he kind of looked at me on the grass and just, you know, he realized I had made it home safe. I was going to graduate. I was a good kid. I mowed the yard. I made my grades. And he didn't, you know, he didn't make a big stink about it. My son is drunk. And I just remember he kind of looked at me, kind of like that, and went back in the house.
Did he ever sit you down for one of those frank man-to-man discussions about alcohol or drugs?
Never.
And my dad never did either. And most of the time when I was around him, when I was that age, I was stoned or drunk too. So, and I don't know if he just didn't want to see it or he saw it and ignored it or whatever, but most of the time I felt like I was just pulling it over on my mother and father. I grew a pot plant in my bedroom at home. And my mother used to water it. She used to thought it was just a really nice plant. And so you had some experience drinking in high school, but it's really when you pledged. Did you actually pledge Sigma Chi?
I pledged ZBT.
Okay. So you got into the Greek system.
Mm, it was all about drinking.
First of all, why were you interested in being in a fraternity where a lot of people aren't?
When I was 18, I saw that. It's funny that you ask that now because it was the last thing I would do, although I'm dear friends with all those guys to this day. Sober John is. But when I was going to college, I saw that as my only means of connection. A lot of those guys went to Bel Air with me, mm-hmm. and there was no way that I was going to go up to UT and not try to get into a fraternity. It was almost like it wasn't an option.
So you had good enough grades to get in, as did your friends. So what happened next? You get out of high school, you go up to Austin to go to school at UT. What's next in John's life?
4 years of scratching and clawing my way through college. I really struggled, not in high school, but in college, because the drinking and fraternity life, I allowed it to get in the way of what should have been 4 years of, you know, really focusing on why I'm there to get the best grades possible. Almost the way I see it today is I should have been repaying my parents more for such a gift to be able to go up to school there. And what I was focused on was the fraternity and girls.
That's easy enough to do. I mean, I think especially we get out of our parents' home and we're on our own, and all the things we couldn't do when we were living at home, we're suddenly free to be able to do. Mm-hmm. Is that how you found your life?
Absolutely.
Were you a functional drinker, or when you drank, you just couldn't get anything done?
I was definitely a functional drinker. In fact, the hangovers, some of them were pretty horrific, and they would keep me from drinking for a long time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was much more important to be out on Lake Travis or Lake Austin or playing basketball or doing intramural sports. Uh-huh. And, you know, I don't want to discredit myself. I did make it through there and get a degree. But I was well aware that the poison that I felt from alcohol was, you know, I never became a daily drinker in college. Although I did see that happen to one of my pledge brothers, and it was the strangest thing because I didn't know what alcoholism was when I was a freshman. And the guy, he just stopped showing up one day, and I was like, "What happened to Brian?" I was like, "Oh, he's." I noticed he was drunk every
right,
day.
Right. Yeah.
In the freshman year, but then he was just gone. And I was like, how did that happen? Why did he let that happen? But it was kind of an eye-opener for me.
Did he leave school or?
Yeah, he just
split.
Yeah.
So was that the first time you ever questioned the drinking that you were doing, to think about him and think about your situation?
Not at all. Didn't even come into my radar.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I think at that point, he just can't handle his liquor. Like I can.
Yeah.
So the blackouts and the hangovers, I should say, got you a few weeks, a few days worth of sobriety because you didn't want to feel that way or you had to get work done.
Right. I would say I wasn't even drinking to that level when I was in college. Even after college, which I call my lost decade, was the 90s. I wouldn't go out without drinking, but it was... You know, I always remember trying to manage it, have to have one or two drinks. We'd end up at the Volcano Lounge. There was a lot of drinking in my life. It was a strange existence trying to balance drinking with all the other things I wanted to do because it made me so sick.
You called that the lost decade. Lost in what way?
You know, looking back with sobriety, I felt like there's so much more I could have done if I was sober during that time. And my priorities were, you know, for the first few years of the 90s, I had a lot of friends in Austin, so I would wait till Friday, start drinking, get on the road, go up to 6th Street or 5th Street and spend the weekend with my friends. And if I wasn't doing that, drinking in Austin, I would, you know, drink at different spots around Houston. And it just... Nothing ever comes from that, meeting out in bars, and, you know, there was nothing positive that came out of it.
Along the way, were you noticing that, or is it only in retrospect that you can see that?
Only in retrospect. The only thing that was a wake-up call was a few horrific hangovers.
How about, you said you would drink and then you'd get on the road. Did you ever get any DUIs or any stopped for public intoxication?
Never. I got lucky, though.
Yeah. So you were one of the fortunate ones. There are a lot of guys in prison doing your time and my time. Because I never had a DUI either. Times I should have. And the times I got stopped, I somehow was able to convince them that I wasn't drunk. Or they just didn't want to bother. I don't know. So after school, were you working that whole time during the 90s?
Mm-hmm.
Was your drinking confined to after work, or when were you finding time to drink?
It was always a weekend thing, or very little if there was a happy hour during the week. But it was always either a Friday or a Saturday night. And I can remember that frozen screwdrivers at Volcanoes or some party, and then balancing that with how miserable I felt the next day would keep me from drinking for a while.
Now, when you say for a while, what are we talking about, weeks?
Yeah, just a few weeks. But I knew that if I was going to be any place that was social, I would have to have a few drinks and just sort of try to manage that whole thing to get through with life, to get by in life.
Yeah. I had the same kind of challenges where I felt really uncomfortable being anywhere social without having a few drinks and a few, you know, joints of courage. And, you know, it changed my personality. And I really had a lot of fun under the influence, but I couldn't not do that. Did you find yourself in a similar situation?
Absolutely.
What was that like?
I remember once being asked to attend a wedding with this friend of mine, and I was so nervous about going to the wedding that I drank, I think there were 17 shots I counted by the end of the night, to feel like I fit in during the, it was just a beautiful wedding with friends from high school. There was no reason to even have one drink, but for John to fit in at this event, I think I had, it was Seagram's and Seven, and when I woke up the next day, the hangover was coming out of my forehead like needles. And I was sick for about a day and a half. And I remember getting on the other side of that event and just thinking, why did you have to do that to yourself?
And you had that hangover, and it was bad enough that you questioned why you had to do it. A lot of times people, and people I've interviewed and people you and I both know in the program, have a difficult time putting two and two together at that point. How was your arithmetic?
It never dawned on me that I could be someone in need of sobriety.
Hmm.
I just remember thinking that I'll manage this better or just stop drinking because it made me physically sick. But I saw my grandfather drink successfully his entire life.
But you said you thought he was an alcoholic.
I did. I think Chris D told me it was a functioning alcoholic without the spiritual malady. That's what he described it as.
Not a bad way to get along if you want to be getting drunk all the time, huh?
Right.
Hmm. So you saw some kind of connection between your own life and what your kind of life you perceived that your grandfather had had. So he could drink. You saw him being able to get along. Maybe you could do the same thing.
It would always be there for me.
Always be there.
Right.
Did it ever work out that way?
Never.
Yeah. I can understand why. Yeah, that's tough when you get to that realization, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned some drugs earlier, too. Were these also involved along the way, or did they pick up at another point?
It picked up at another point. It's what took me down. So yeah, 90s was the lost decade.
And that's around alcohol, predominantly?
Predominantly drugs.
So alcohol was a part of that mix, but the drugs also, that's how it was for me. In fact, there were times I didn't drink because I thought the drugs were working so much better. Why spoil them? But then eventually the booze found its way into my body too. How did you get along with that?
Had never really used any drugs until I met a coworker, and this is probably 1996. I started working at the job where that occurred, and by 1998, I think I had enough trust in this friend at work to, because he had mentioned, you know, using cocaine and ecstasy, and I finally got the guy to trust me enough to share some, and that's where it all started. One coworker, one bump after work, and I was off to the races.
You were hooked that quickly?
Yeah.
Hmm. So what was next?
As soon as I tried it, I got the phone number of the person who was supplying him. It was of vital importance to me to have a supply. And what was next is a great question, because there were two things happening in my life at the same time. Mm-hmm. One was this success and really hard work at this new job, which, you know, I was 6 years into the job. It's mutual fund accounting, and I was working very hard, and I was grateful for this success I was having there. And I bought my first home and was, you know, just enjoying feeling financially stable, having a manageable life. And at the same time, I had found a supplier for cocaine, which I was using just on Friday evenings after the long work week. Mm. I would sit there on the counter at my table and in my kitchen and just do a few lines and call friends on Friday evening after a long work week. I thought it was harmless.
How long did you do that for?
Several months.
Okay, so you were a recreational or social drug user at that point.
Yes.
You weren't yet a drug abuser.
That's right.
I didn't like cocaine because of the cost. It seemed like a high cost for such a short period of being high. And I could never get enough of it at any one time to get past that. So I stuck to weed most of the time. I smoked a lot of weed. Were you a weed user as well?
No, weed. I tried a few times in the 90s. Uh-huh. And once in college, I had a quarter bag yeah. of weed. But the few times I tried it, it made me paranoid. And I sort of had a problem with time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever had that experience of time, but just anyway. So I stopped again. I didn't use it or pursue it because it made me absolutely paranoid.
And alcohol was still doing the trick at that point, right?
Right.
You got infatuated with cocaine. Mm-hmm. You mentioned using it for a couple of months just after work one evening a week. When did you turn the corner to greater usage, and how was it affecting your life at this point?
Well, it was taking me away from life again.
In what ways?
Because I would rather be at home doing a few
lines
and having a few drinks alone, right? And you know, there's that term drunk dialing when you call your friends, but I was coke dialing my friends because, as you referred to, it's a really short lasting high, and it's expensive, hard to get, and it's just not very pleasant. And I discovered that pretty quickly. And it could have all ended there, actually, except that the person who was supplying me turned me on to amphetamines.
Oh, okay.
And so once I had the meth, it was game over. Hmm.
So you gave up the cocaine to turn yourself over to methamphetamines?
Exactly. Hmm. Hmm.
What did you find in them that you weren't finding in cocaine?
I would do the tiniest amount, and it would last for 8 hours, feel like I was on top of the world. Hmm. Everything that I wanted from the other things, the alcohol and other substances, the amphetamine just completely brought me out of myself. I was able to interact, go out again, all those things.
Yeah, and it just seemed to do the trick, huh?
Oh, yeah.
How long did it do the trick for you before you started having problems with it?
It was all a problem day one, but it's a great question. 2.5 years. Yeah. It took 2.5 years from that first bump to the house was gone. The job was gone. I was back living in my old apartment. However, I was no longer leasing the apartment, so I was sleeping in my truck outside the apartment because the guys were coming in to tear out the floors for the next tenant. And that all occurred in 2.5 years of the moment I found amphetamine.
2.5 years. It is a very quick descent, isn't it?
Yes.
One of our friends, George Jay, who I interviewed quite a couple of years ago and did an encore podcast with him, said that the reason that you see a lot of people in rehab, a lot of younger people in rehab, is that the drugs work so much more quickly at taking them down than alcohol. Alcohol you can live with for a lot longer without consequences, without health-related issues, than you can with drugs. So the descent is much quicker. You know, you crash more quickly so that maybe you can be saved from the crash, or you hit bottom and maybe you can get out of that by going to rehab or something like that. What was your experience with that?
No, that's exactly what happened. I just remember finally realizing it was much greater than anything I could control, and I left my job. I had a $5,000 check in my pocket. It's unpaid vacation, and I came back to my apartment, and I was finally free from that thing, which I couldn't manage anymore, which was my job. It was a beautiful day in June of 2003. I was standing in front of my apartment and thinking I had finally made it. I was going to just enjoy the summer, use a little bit longer, do all the stuff I'd always wanted to do, and then I would go back to my life. So it was one of the most free moments I'd ever had, just standing in front of my apartment with the job in the rearview mirror and having $5,000 in my pocket, thinking I had figured it all out.
It sounds like a decision that was heavily influenced while you were under the influence. Is that a safe thing to say?
Yes, I was going to work under the influence every day for about 6 months.
Well, if they were amphetamines, you must have been getting a lot of work done for a while there, huh?
Yes, that part of it works for a little while, maybe the first few months, but then it quickly turns, and I began to realize that I really wasn't getting a lot of work done.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of an illusion that comes with the drug use.
We'll be right back. My friends, if you're enjoying AA Recovery Interviews, I invite you to check out my latest audiobook, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how more than 100 men have recovered from alcoholism. This is the word-for-word, cover-to-cover reading of the first edition of the Big Book, published in 1939. It's a relaxing yet meaningful and engaging way to listen to the Big Book anytime, any place. Have a free listen at Audible, iTunes, or Amazon. While you're there, search for my other audiobook, Lost Stories of the Big Book, 30 original stories from the first and or second editions missing from the third and fourth editions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also available from Amazon as a Kindle book or in paperback if you'd like to read along. You're going to love it. And we're back.
We're talking about a period of 2.5 years for you to just crash and burn at that point.
Yes.
What were the final days like for you?
I remember July 4th. The only reason I knew it was July 4th was because I heard the fireworks going off outside. I would convulse as I went to sleep at night, which is kind of like this, kicking. And I had these lesions up here in the upper part of my shoulder, because I was malnourished. So my skin was kind of oozing a little bit. And the way I got by each day was I would try to walk down the street and get a smoothie or to get some kind of food in my body so I could sleep for a few hours and use again the next day. But when I saw the lesions up here near my shoulder, I knew that my time was coming to an end.
How did the amphetamines ultimately take over your life at that point?
I had to have it every day. Woke up to feel normal.
So you were an everyday, all-day user.
Yes.
You quit the job to take the vacation that was unpaid for, but you had the $5,000 check. When did you lose the house?
I had sold the house about a year before. I got very lucky in that I was able to sell my house and not run into any kind of strange situation like that. It would put me upside down. But the drug itself is not so expensive. It's everything you do on the drug that takes the money quickly. I would just go do something every day, pretty much. I would either buy something I didn't need. To be honest with you, I don't even know what happened to the money.
So does it mess with your impulse control?
Absolutely. Here's an example. At one point, I had this nice stereo in my truck, and it was like an Alpine, and I had these really nice speakers, but somebody kept breaking into my truck. This is the insanity of the meth addict. And so I would get the window repaired, go out, buy the same stereo again, replace it, and then a few weeks later my truck would be broken into, the stereo would be gone. So I spent you know, a few thousand dollars just replacing a stereo I never needed because I just kept leaving my truck unlocked.
How many times did it get stolen? Four, three times.
God. It's an insane life. It's absolutely insane, unmanageable life. And also going out to bars with friends, but, you know, spending too much money in the bar because when you're on that drug, you can drink forever. And I didn't want my friends to know. I thought of it as my secret little chippy on my shoulder. I had a secret they didn't know about. So I can be up till 2 a.m. plus in the after hours bars drinking because all alcohol did was sort of taper things down. Mm. And I think I had a lot of people fooled, but I probably didn't.
During your sobriety, have you gone back to some of those people to find out what they were thinking about you at that time? Have you had any feedback from people since then?
Yeah, what a great question. I never thought about that. Yes, most of them are my friends to this day. One of them absolutely gave up on me because his father died from this disease, so he had no inclination that I was going to get sober or be sober. They usually they root for me, and a few of them had no idea that I was that sick. They just wondered when I disappeared to go to treatment what happened to John.
So one day you're going out to bars with these people. You're keeping up drink for drink. You're probably putting some of them under the table while your amphetamines are allowing you to drink with impunity, so to speak, large quantities.
Exactly. Absolute impunity.
Did you have blackouts or hangovers?
No.
So the amphetamines did their job, huh?
Right. It kind of rots you from the inside. So it was sort of like a malnourished convulsions, bad dreams, things like that.
So here's a $64,000 question. At what point did you attribute what was going on to you physically to the meth?
Oh, I knew it from day one.
You did? Okay. So what were you telling yourself to make it okay to continue to do it?
Didn't care and just was chasing the high by that point. I had to have it to feel normal.
How was your self-esteem at the time?
When I was using? I was through the roof, but it was completely fake.
So you were the guy who could get everything done.
Yes.
You were the guy to get on the, people should get on your coattails and follow you to wherever?
It was two groups of friends. I would follow them, but it was a period of time where I felt like I could just go anywhere and hang out all night.
It almost seems like the meth was making you psychotic?
I wouldn't say psychotic. I would say falsely connected, false connection.
False connection.
Yeah. It gives you a deep sense of interest in your friends that's completely fake. It makes you feel like everything is interesting. You want to find out, know everything about everyone, and you can, you know, like you alluded to, drink all night and just be out in the bars with impunity.
So this happens right up till December of 2004.
December of 2004 is when I got sober. So this happened right up until the summer of 2003.
So there's this period between the summer of 2003 and December of 2004, which are pivotal in your story.
Yeah, that 18 months of hell.
So talk about that. What was it like living in 18 months of hell?
Well, after I left treatment, I lasted 4 days before I started using again. So 28 days in treatment, 4 days at home. I was actually had a friend from treatment in my apartment, which is a horrible idea, by the way.
Yeah.
And I made it 4 days until I started using again.
Were you physically addicted?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So did you have to go through some kind of withdrawal?
No, it's a mental, emotional withdrawal. It's not a physical one.
What were they convincing you of during the 28 days, or what were you learning? What was going on during that 4 week period that gave you hope or that seemed like total bullshit?
By the time that I went in, I knew the gig was up. I had no idea what it took to stay sober. I just knew that there was enough of John in there that wanted to kind of return to my old self, not be a drug addict, not be an alcoholic. And when I got into treatment, we had a great house. And I really wanted to go in May because I was already kind of going by there, as I told you about earlier when I met Christy.
Yeah.
And so I was already missing the first group of friends I had made. And, you know, I would go in every once in a while and just go back and do my thing. That doesn't work. But when I went, that's such a good question, Howard. I felt a camaraderie with these guys the moment I got in there. The way it was George Jay's place, and the way that he ran it was at night there was this check-in. And so I went from being, you know, basically like this at home on the couch to no more drugs in my system. So it's shocking and scary, but you're around, you know, it's probably about 18 or 20 guys in the house, and we're, you know, eating three meals a day, for example, doing assignments, recovery assignments. They were mostly geared around the first three steps. But the most important thing that I was feeling human again. We had a lot of activities. We would go play basketball. We would go to St. Thomas and work out and shoot baskets. And I put together a softball team in treatment. I've always loved baseball and, you know, that kind of thing. But to your question, it was the nightly wrap-up and just seeing my friends around this circle, the ones that hadn't left that day, and checking in with how I was feeling. And the first time I realized that, hey, these guys, they actually care. And these, especially George, he would, you know, he wasn't an absentee landlord. He had programs there. And so we would sit in this circle and do a final check-in and fill out a little questionnaire. And so it was, especially with my roommate, Zach, I remember feeling connected to these people and not wanting to let them down when I left the place. 4 weeks.
So that happens within a 4 week period. Mm-hmm. When you get to the 28 days, do you go somewhere else at that point?
No, I just went home.
You just went home.
They ejected me.
What were they telling you about AA?
Oh, everything.
Did you feel compelled to go to AA once you got out?
It happened before I got out. The place was so well run. A friend from high school, David D., picked me up with Jason W., and I remember that Joe set it up. And I was just out on the patio one evening. It was a Friday, and this Jeep Grand Cherokee pulls up, and the guys get out of the vehicle, and they're like, "Hey, you need to get in the car. We're going to poker night." And I was like, "Poker night? What's that?" And so they whisked me away to my first men's meeting.
We're talking about 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, it was 20 years ago that they took me.
So all the AA you were doing. But yet you said you still came out, and within 4 days you were doing meth again.
Yes. That lasted 4 days.
How is that possible?
That's a great question. No sponsor yet. 4 days away from treatment with someone in treatment who wasn't working the steps, and just having lunch, and the thought came in. I always had this thing back then. I said it would come into the side of my head. Coming through my right ear, and I was just looking at him like, you know, I'm gonna use this evening. And he didn't object or try to stop me. And I remember going from lunch to my dealer's house.
With everything that had been done for you and with you, with your cooperation and involvement in the 28-day process there, and you were going to AA meetings in that facility, with all of that being done, when the thought hit you to do the meth, in any way was it followed up with, I better make a phone call. I better call George or Chris or somebody else over there. That never occurred to you?
Not at all.
And your friend didn't try and talk you out of it?
Not at all.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So how long did that last? You were sober for 28 days, right? So that's your first period of continuous sobriety.
Yes.
And then you slip on meth. Did you also go back to booze at that point?
Yes, and I still had the alcohol in my apartment. So one could say I wasn't really ready, even though I had been in treatment for 28 days. But I was probably just using for a short period of time, just a few days, before I realized that it was no longer like it was before. Things got creepy really quickly. And I had friends, new friends, sober friends that were texting and calling and saying, hey, are you going to go to Bob's meeting Wednesday night? And I'm at home again using, and it just went together like a pile of...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So these people are calling you thinking you're still sober.
Yeah.
And you were telling them what?
I wasn't even answering the phone.
Okay.
So it's just it went from bliss to chaos.
It sounds like a recipe for disaster. And it occurs to me that why would you want to stop at that point when all this craziness is coming your way? Craziness in the form of people actually caring whether or not you're sober.
Right.
Did that make you want to use more?
It made me want to get back to, I'd already seen people picking up desire chips, and I kind of knew how it worked. So it made me want to get back.
Okay. So there was something about that experience that hit you in the right way, let's say. That moment of clarity that people talk about, did you have one of those? Or if it wasn't a moment of clarity, a turning point or an aha moment that made you decide, I really need to do this now?
Yes.
When did that happen?
After my fourth relapse, about 18 months after treatment. It would have been December of 2004. I had a full day of that experience, aha moment.
How much sobriety were you able to put together during that 18-month period?
The longest one was 6 months. On the day of my six-month ship, I was out to score. That was my last relapse.
So four relapses, including the original one?
Mm-hmm.
So you got four desire chips?
At least. Do we have to change my story now?
No, not at all. Just during this time, did you have a sponsor? Were you actually working the program in any way whatsoever?
Yes. I had two great sponsors. One was in the car that night. I got whisked away to poker night. And he helped me. I guess with both of these sponsors during the relapse time, I had made it up to about step eight. And that's when I would implode, right around step eight.
What was there about that step that made you implode?
Nothing too terrifying for me, but I just remember, you know, people were telling me, you know, you have to do this, this, and this. And in my mind, I was like, you know what? I go to meetings. I've got a sponsor. I'm on step eight. I'm okay. I don't need to do all of that. So I would be sort of, I wouldn't say half-assing it, but I was just sort of, you know, 90% in, maybe.
Going through the motions.
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely working the steps. I did a very thorough fourth step. But I would just sort of be hanging out around step eight, and then boom, it would happen again.
So step eight allowed you to keep other people at bay while you were already slipping.
Right. And when you say slip, the last one, I remember I was literally walking up the steps to my upstairs luxury concierge room at the halfway house. You don't get upstairs unless you have a few months of sobriety. And I was, you know, doing nothing except for going to a few meetings, but I was walking up the stairs. I was working my program instead of the program. That's the best way I can put it. But I was going up the steps on a beautiful day, and I had 6 months, and the thought came in again. And I just walked right back down the steps, got in my car, and drove out to score, completely powerless over the thought at that time.
How did that powerlessness show up? Was there a cry for help, or was it very subtle? What it sounds to me like after four slips, and you're living in the halfway house pretty much this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So they endured you slipping four times?
No, I was in my apartment about half the time. There were two stints in the halfway house, and I told on myself when it happened.
And so they let you back in?
Right.
Oh, I get it.
The guy who let me back in has since passed away, sober.
Sober. Mm-hmm. That's good news.
Yeah.
Well, it's tragic news, but it's good news nonetheless that he stayed sober till the end. Okay, so this 18-month period brings us up to your moment of truth.
Mm-hmm. I had met a guy named Gabe who was going to the meetings, all the meetings I was going to, but he was staying sober. And I know that he was taking guys through the steps. It took about 3 weeks, and I would just see him reaching out to newcomers in the meeting all the time. And it just impressed me. And I knew that if I engaged him for some help, that it was not, I wasn't going to let this guy down either. It was just this moment of clarity where I was like, I knew if I reached out to this guy that we were going to get through all the steps. And I would either know at that point whether AA or recovery was going to work for me, or I could just let it go and give up on myself. But I knew I had to reach out to this guy and do everything he said, and that was the change.
That was the change.
Yeah.
How did you feel about the spiritual aspect of the program at that point?
I didn't know what it was. I just know that when he gave me the last assignment on Chapter 7, working with others, Step 12, it took hours. It was intense. It had a lot of things I had to search out in the literature, and I finished almost to just prove to myself that this wasn't going to work. And I remember finishing the last assignment. It took about 3 weeks. I got up from the table in my apartment, and I felt like a different person inside.
Huh.
It wasn't that I had completed my third step or done a fourth step again. It was that I had done all the steps. And it was near Christmas time. I drove across town, went into a Christmas party with a room full of people I didn't even know and felt completely comfortable. With 20 days sober, I just felt as if something had changed.
So that was a real moment of truth for you. Did you acknowledge it immediately, or is that something that you think back on and say, that was when I had my moment of truth, or were you in the present moment when that was going on?
That was definitely my moment of truth. You know, within a short time after that, I think I had 67 days sober, he told me I was going to sponsor people. And if I wasn't going to sponsor people, he told me to my face, then you're going to use again, and I can't help you. So it was a little bit of that and a little bit of just immediately going right back to where I went to treatment and picking up sponsees and starting to take people through the steps, even though I didn't even have 3 months sober.
So he taught you how to be a sponsor in this three-month period.
Teaching me how to be a sponsor wasn't just something that he taught. It was a priority for him. He actually did a mock step review with me, and he said, because there was a guide. Follow the guide. And we sat down one evening, and he made me go through each step of it and say, oh, what about this part? And what about this, you know, little thing we did? And so he sort of built a confidence in me to do it early. Yeah.
That's amazing. So we've got you sober now, and you get to your sober date. We talked a little bit earlier about your feelings about the topic tonight, and I always like to ask, what are some of the milestones in your sobriety, what you did or didn't do that changed your trajectory along the way? Because it's never a straight arrow. Is it always, you know, a little bit this way, self-correcting? What would you say some of the milestones are in your sobriety, good and bad?
Oh, what a question. Oof. The first milestone was definitely getting to 1 year sober. Once I got my first one-year chip, my only one-year chip, hopefully, I remember thinking there is no way in the world I would ever throw away a year of sobriety. I was a job changer. I would run away from the job when work became too uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And staying at the job was a big deal for me. The job I have today, I've been there for 8 years, and it's been one of the most successful, abundant, grace-filled times I've ever had in my life. So not running anymore. Watching my relationship with my sister, who there was almost no relationship with her when I got sober. And watching and getting the opportunity to be Uncle John to my nieces and seeing, having this relationship with my sister where she actually wants me in her life and vice versa, of course.
How long did that take?
It just happened over a period of years.
Huh.
And there's too many things. Buying a house again, I never thought I would own a home. And really just feeling grateful for the things that I have instead of I need to get these things so I will fit in. It's more like a gratitude for the life I have and the things that I have.
So the way you work your job, your home, these are all demonstrations of a program that's being worked. You always strike me as being one of the most grateful people I know because you're always talking about it. Any other things that happened with it? I know you lost your dad.
Yeah.
Not all that long ago, and I saw AA kind of surround you at that point. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. And talk about a time when my sister really showed up. There was the last 2 years of his life, we were really involved in helping him. And we got him into an assisted living, first independent living, but then an assisted living. And he passed on February 13th, 2022.
Mm.
And so being able to be sober and show up for him without going crazy as much as possible was us. The way that whole thing transpired, I think, is just I have to give credit to God for. But my sister lived in North Carolina, and she was. It seemed to me like she was here every month for 2 years. I don't know how she did it, but she would come down, and then, you know, 30 or 40 days later, she said, "I'll be there next week." Hmm. So she was an incredible help to me in having someone else who could spend time with him.
You guys were there to make sure that he got the care that he needed.
Yes.
I did the same thing with my mother, and 2 hours after I closed her eyes when she breathed her last breath, 2 hours later I was in an AA meeting sharing about it.
I think I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, and I've heard you talk about how close you were to the program at that time too. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. At first I didn't want to share about it too much.
Why?
I don't know. I just didn't want to burden others with it,
yeah,
I guess.
I get that.
And there was a time when I thought I was just going to quit my job because it was getting overwhelming. He was getting sick with UTIs, Memorial Hermann, falling down. One time he smashed his face against the curb.
Yeah.
And there were some other difficulties that he had in sort of integrating with that community there, so I thought it was going to become overwhelming, but it never really did. I just the way the whole thing happened was I have to give credit to God for that, for everything.
You stayed really close to the program too at that point, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was seeing you in meetings all the time, and you were sharing about that, but you were in a meeting sharing about it, which to me I think is the most important thing of all. From time to time, I see you sitting in meetings with your eyes closed. Tell me what that's about.
Yeah, I love to listen to what others are sharing. I'm not meditating in the meeting, but I love to go into sort of a meditative state. And I think meditation is a huge part of my life. And I say that, but I don't do it enough. I don't make... I'm not as disciplined as I wish I was.
Is it a mindfulness type meditation?
It just focuses on my breath. So when I'm in the meetings, I mean, I equally like to look at the person too, because AA is not meditation, and I'm real clear about that. But when I'm in a meeting like we are tonight, I feel like if I close my eyes, sometimes I can focus on what's being said, and I try to do that. Just listen to what someone's sharing.
I always just assumed that it was, you know, you were just tuning up a little bit more closely to what was being said.
Yeah, definitely not sleeping.
No, I never thought you were, because you look too content while you're doing that. So that's very, very cool.
Thank you.
So what's next in your sobriety? Where do you see your sobriety taking you from here?
Oh, man, I hadn't thought about that.
It doesn't necessarily have to have an answer either, so...
Okay.
I asked that question with the idea that if we really are truly focused in the present moment, we're not necessarily going to know where we're going.
Right.
But we might have an idea about which way we want to lean.
I would like to take a few more guys through the steps this year than, you know, I don't think I took anyone through during the time of caring for my dad. And I've had a few false starts lately. So what's next is to continually reach out and work with guys. And when I say work with someone, I mean going through the steps. I don't mean calling someone on the phone. All that stuff is important. It's great. But there's also a lot of change coming down the pipe where I work for employment.
Mm-hmm.
And what's next is trusting my higher power with that and not getting overwhelmed by it, trusting God with it. No matter how impossible or possible it seems, there's a lot of change going on, and sometimes that scares me. I'm 55 years old, and I'll be honest with you, I've figured out ways to early retire, and I want
good
to,
for you.
I want to sort of avoid that right now,
yeah,
because
yeah.
I figured out, like, you know, I've, you know, in a good place now, and I could work at, you know, Starbucks and still make my expenses. So
yeah, I get that.
I don't want to do that right now, but I've always, it's sort of a fantasy I have is to find the job that'll give me more vacation time. I don't have that right now, which is okay. But I'm always thinking about that because there's a lot of cool things I've done in sobriety that I was not doing before sobriety, like saltwater fishing, triathlons, you know, learning how to play golf, and I haven't done a lot of that lately.
Well, this has been just a wonderful experience, John. As well as I've known you for as long as I've known you, there are parts of your story that I never really fully knew or connected with other parts of your story. To me, doing these interviews is a way to kind of put together the little bits and pieces that we learn about each other in the 3 to 5 minutes that we share in a meeting. But this has just been a lovely opportunity to talk with you and enhance our friendship. And I want to really thank you for doing this. I love you, and you're a good friend.
I love you too. Thanks for having me.
Great AA brother. Anything you want to say to drunks of the world tonight?
I want to add one final thing. You'd mentioned this. It really is true about my story. I think it came from George J. originally, that I'm actually lucky because the addiction that I had brought me in much quicker. And I could easily have been John G. here, you know, 55 years old, in his first month of sobriety after 20 years of drinking. And so I am grateful that it happened that way because it just, I got through that part quicker. And it's very true for addicts. Now, the downside of that is you can die quicker.
That's true. So
it didn't happen to me,
well,
but
especially nowadays.
You mentioned that twice, and it's exactly my story. It just brought me in so quickly. And also, I came in with the idea that I was terminally unique and that there was no way AA was going to work for me because I was, you know, so special. You can't find my story in that big book, but that's, you just have to cast that to the side and work this program. It works for everyone. I just respect that, though, when I'm in AA meetings. I don't talk about the other stuff because I understand that these 90% of these guys are alcoholics, and they're wanting to hear about alcoholism.
True, but those of us who are strictly alcoholics, I still think they gain a lot from, if nothing more than just gratitude, that they didn't have to go through what you went through with methamphetamines, right?
Mm-hmm.
It all works out in the end, doesn't it?
It does.
Well, John, again, many thanks, and we will see each other soon.
Thanks, Howard.
Thanks, John. Well, my friends, that's it for today's episode of AA Recovery Interviews. I want to thank my guest, John G., for sharing his story. And thank you for tuning in. If you've enjoyed the interviews in this podcast series, will you please share it with others? This show is another helping hand of AA we can all extend to alcoholics everywhere. If you want to contact me directly with any comments, questions, or suggestions, simply email howard@aarecoveryinterviews.com. Please also take a minute to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. By the way, this podcast strictly adheres to AA's 12 traditions and all General Service Office guidelines for safeguarding anonymity online. AA Recovery Interviews and my guests do not speak for or represent AA at large. This podcast is simply my way of giving back to AA that which has been so freely given to me. The next episode of AA Recovery Interviews is on the way, so keep coming back. It'll be here soon.